This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
What is up, y'all? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network, where every day we give you real news and great conversation. I'm so excited to bring my next special guest to the show, Civic Media's very own political editor, Dan Schaefer. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for making time.
Good afternoon, Maggie. Always a treat to join you here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
So we opened up a discussion about Donald Trump's announcement of tariffs yesterday, which, of course, he did via Truth Social, the best place for complex macroeconomic policy announcements. And we've been talking about what this is going to mean for the middle class and especially for Wisconsinites. My argument has been that these kinds of tariffs are just stupid economics, and they will end up hurting the middle class, hurting the very manufacturers, especially in the auto industry, in the construction industry, that employ literally tens of millions of Americans. It's going to make stuff more expensive. It's going to make it less likely that we're going to see real wage increases. It's going to make it more likely that we're going to see layoffs. And I want to get to some of the great texts and comments, but Dan, I wanted to get your take on all of this. Where do you sit on the tariffs? Do you think this is going to work? Is it going to stop the fentanyl? Is it going to lead to some sort of magic immigration fix? What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be a particularly effective policy. It's starting your administration this next term by essentially kicking off a trade war with Mexico, because you saw some of the reaction from the Mexican president as well. So, but you're kicking off this trade war. I saw another piece of this involving Canada in the same way that you're involving Mexico in this. And that is going to have a real impact on gas prices in the Midwest, because a lot of the gas that comes to the Midwest, a lot of the oil that comes to the Midwest comes from Canada as well. So I think that is going to have an impact. So if you voted for Trump for lower prices on groceries, on gas, this is not going to have that effect. I think we're seeing, a kind of across the board concern from macroeconomics in the country. And I think, with good reason. But I do think, politically, I think about this in the context of the legacy of NAFTA. And I think that there was a great piece from my friend Dan Kaufman, who wrote for The New Yorker and writes for The New York Times Magazine. He had a piece before the election on how NAFTA broke American politics in a lot of ways. So I think this is, like we saw in 2016 when Trump won the first time. He has all these promises about this economic populism, bringing manufacturing back to the Midwest. Well, it didn't work the first time. And so there's really no evidence to suggest it's going to work this time. In fact, there was a lot more evidence to suggest that the Biden administration's policies, bolstered manufacturing in a lot more ways by investing in the Chips and Science Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, a lot of these types of things. Whereas those types of policies that Trump advanced during his first term were not particularly effective. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that these policies are going to be effective in Trump's second term either.
Couldn't agree with you more. And just on the NAFTA piece, I've talked about this on my show. Every single economist, objective, legitimate economist with integrity, knew back when NAFTA was being debated. And by the way, NAFTA was a Republican trade deal that moved through the Newt Gingrich-controlled Congress back then. Yes, Bill Clinton agreed to it, but it was a Republican idea. Free trade agreements has been part of the conservative sort of economic orthodoxy for decades. Every economist knew when, if you move forward with something like NAFTA, it is going to lead to job loss in the United States and wage decreases, right? Because frankly, if you can make something and pay a worker pennies on the dollar in another country and import it without these kinds of protectivist measures, that's what's going to happen. Everybody knew you're going to need relocation programs and job upskilling and reskilling. None of that was included in the NAFTA legislation. And frankly, Republicans have opposed those sorts of measures that would have enabled middle-class workers whose jobs were lost to be nimble, to be able to find different and new employment and not suffer these economic hardships. We seem to be doing sort of slapstick macroeconomic policy yet again with very little concern about the impact on middle-class families. Briefly, I want to go to the text lines. Lots of good comments. Kimber from Muskoda said this: didn't Joe Biden also help increase our capability for production in some of the industries that we have previously been very dependent upon China for, including the CHIPS Act? Yes, this has been, that was one of the driving factors behind the CHIPS Act that Joe Biden got accomplished, was to try to side us some of the manufacturing of these critical microchips for basically everything that we use now, from your refrigerator to your phone to your little smart device speaker and everything in between, including automobiles, etc. Kimber, thank you for the holiday greetings right back at you. Andrew from Maine pointing out that wouldn't it be smarter to actually decriminalize drugs, try to eliminate or regulate the black market, tax it, and again, go through whether you're trying to do treatment, get people off of drugs, et cetera. Yes, as an economist, I've always been in the legalize it camp, because that is a demand that never goes away unless you actually move into a treatment and decriminalization phase. That's not where we've gotten in our country. Tyler from Columbia County saying this: want to pay more taxes? ? Most items used in schools outside of food and toilet paper usually are imported, including all of the technology. School referendums have been such a huge thing in Wisconsin, Dan, because all of our school districts have been starved of the resources that they need. Yep, those dollars are going to go even less far with these tariffs in place. And from Chippewa Falls, it will be like another pandemic. The rich will get richer. Totally agree, Ann. The last time we saw massive tariffs as a source of baseline economic policy in our country was back in the early 1900s. And in fact, it was one of the precursor factors that led to the Great Depression. Those tariffs didn't end up benefiting the middle class. They actually helped the monopolizers of that time, because we didn't have anti-monopoly regulations on the book. The Sherman Act didn't exist. Our antitrust laws didn't exist back then. That allowed these industrialists that had near monopolies, or indeed monopolies in steel and railroads and all these kinds of things, to extract extremely high prices from the middle class. We're approaching that. I mean, who doesn't think that we've got businesses with near monopoly power in our food supply, in our tech spaces, all over the place? Great comment. And Wes from Middleton: I need to see Trump's "I did that" stickers when the prices go up on things. This is Trumpflation every single day. Andrew from Maine pointing out that, again, this is going to raise prices. We've got near $1 trillion of trade being exchanged with Canada, with Mexico. It's over $1 trillion if you take it all together. If you look at the total trade value between these three countries and the U.S., you're approaching $3 trillion. All of those things will be subject to these tariffs and retaliatory tariffs. It is kind of a downward spiral. It's not a good outlook, Dan. And I don't understand how any of this gets sold as economic populism. It doesn't bring manufacturing back to the extent that manufacturers do try to return. It takes a long time to do that.
Right. And even trying to get something in the short term, you know, and again, I just want to go back to what we saw, you know, during Trump's first term. We didn't see a return and a revival of American manufacturing in this country. We saw projects like Foxconn. You know, we saw it right up close and personal here in Wisconsin with this transactional nature. I think that the characterization of Trump being transactional is like kind of a cutesy way of saying that this is kind of in the realm of corrupt behavior, of a pay-to-play type of scenario. And so I think that is the type of thing that we should expect from a second Trump term, not a revival of American manufacturing and not the types of, you know, protectionist trade policy that is not going to be particularly effective.
And here's one of the things that I don't think people are talking about nearly enough, Dan, to your point precisely. Donald Trump used tariffs in his first administration to pick winners and losers. And big surprise, the winners that he picked, the manufacturers that he picked to help with some of these tariffs, were the people that supported Donald Trump. That's not the way capitalism is supposed to work, everybody. That's called autocracy, when the leader of your country gets to determine which businesses succeed. As an example, one study found that Mr. Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum increased U.S. production of those metals by $2.2 billion in 2021. But American factories that used those metals to make cars and food packaging and the appliances that we rely on in our middle-class homes, that caused them to pay higher supply costs, and they saw a $3.5 billion reduction in their production output in that very same year. This is what is distorting about tariff policy. It moves away from capitalism. It moves away from capitalistic democratic principles. Kathy from Madison, thanks for your patience. What do you want to say this afternoon?
Hi, is that me?
Yes, that's you. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. Okay. Well, it's been a very enjoyable good show so far. And I just had to razz you about when you mentioned Muscoda.
Yes.
It's Muscoday.
Oh, Muscoday.
Muscoday, believe it or not. So that's all. I figured you'd get about 100 tests about that. But
I love it. Thanks so much, Kathy. I'm learning every day, and I learn from each and every one of you. Dan Shaver is going to be with us for a bit this afternoon. He is the political editor for Civic Media. One of our texters from WMDX saying this: I keep hearing from all these businesses about raising prices if there are tariffs. Why weren't these business leaders out there and talking about this more before the election? We have just a little bit of time. I'm going to give you my take, because they didn't want to earn Trump's wrath. They didn't want to be one of those loser businesses who gets punished by Donald Trump. Dan, your take?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, you didn't want to They didn't want to put themselves in the line of fire. And I think it's a politically risky maneuver to say something before the election that could have an impact there. And I think that's a big reason why, you know, we're hearing now about places like Walmart saying that, yeah, tariffs are going to increase prices.
We got to take care of some quick business, pay a couple of bills. We're going to be back with political editor Dan Shaver. We're going to talk about that conference I was at last week and how Democrats continue to talk about race and racial justice in this post-election environment. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back, y'all. Welcome if you're just joining. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I got political editor Dan Shaver joining me. We just finished up a conversation about tariffs. But of course, I got yet another great text message that is worthy of airtime. Ben from Sun Prairie, my man, pointing out something that is wonky and yet completely intuitively obvious. So I want to share. Ben says this: business owners have the ability to create a ton of short-term profits based on their existing stock of goods. Because between the time that the tariff is announced, that day they can jack prices up, and yet they'll still be selling based on their existing stock of goods, which creates windfall profits. And the interesting thing about Ben's point, Dan, that I'll mention is this. Small business owners don't have a ton of stock of their goods or the things that they need, the supplies that they need to make their goods. Small business owners tend to run on much thinner production lines, turnaround time, more just-in-time sort of manufacturing. It is typically the largest sellers of finished good products that can actually stock up and store products. So those immediate windfall profits won't go to small business owners. They'll go to the biggest businesses out there. That's point one. Point two, Dan, you had just shared an article about agriculture and farmers in the United States being very concerned about Donald Trump's promise to engage in mass deportation. Talking about tariffs and rising prices for consumer goods and food and new housing starts and automobiles and every electronic in your house, I would be remiss if I didn't say, coupled with Donald Trump's mass deportation policy, however executed, if that starts targeting farm workers, which tend to be migrant or seasonal workers, that is going to have a multiplying effect on rising prices for especially the food that you purchase to feed your family. You've got to see it as a whole. And these two things, tariff policy and the deportation policy, will have a combining and accelerated impact. Wow. So all good things to consider. But Dan, you and I wanted to talk a little bit about how do Democrats move on? How do we continue to have these conversations about racial justice and racial disparities given this election outcome? And I went to a conference last week. It was called Facing Race. It's a conference about racial justice, about how do people continue to do the work to try to decrease disparities between racial groups in this country. And I asked you, Dan, I didn't want to just narrate it. I thought it would be best if you asked some questions about that and we did some thinking together, which with each and every one of you, our great listeners out there, you want to get in on this conversation. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Phone and text lines are open.
Yeah, so you attended this conference over the weekend, and I'm just, I guess my first question for you for this is, what was it like to be at a conference where you're discussing racial justice just a few weeks after Donald Trump was elected to a second term?
Yes, it was, I think, incredibly needed for people that work in the racial justice space, whether they're in the nonprofit space, in the private sector, or they work in government, and you've been paying attention to the disparities in outcome and in wealth, in, you know, what do Black women earn compared to a white man for doing the same job, you know, all of the pay equity, all of those things, housing equity, wealth inequities, all of that. This work is going to continue, and I think people wanted to come together. The conference has been scheduled for a long time, but I think a lot of the content of the sessions changed and shifted given the new political environment. But I'll tell you what was great about it. It was really nice to be amongst 4,000 plus people who care deeply about this work and know that the work is and will continue, and talking about how do we continue to do that work. So it was a little bit of, it was kind of DNC-esque a little bit. It was like half family reunion, half like tent revival. It was good to be amongst people that really do care about this work and understand that the work continues no matter who occupies the White House.
One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about after the election was how different people's reactions are now compared to 2016. How did you find that, you know, at this type of conference?
I think the keynote speaker was Joy Reid, who's one of MSNBC's daily show hosts. And I think her perspective was twofold, and I think it mirrored mine and a lot of sort of the overall take that I got at the conference, which was people are really angry about the place that they find themselves, like their economic situation. People are genuinely angry. It's not just white folks. It's Black folks. It's Latino folks. It's the LGBTQIA community. And that anger has had these spillover impacts. It's been harnessed and sort of channeled in a way by the GOP and certainly the MAGA movement. But that the real fear and anger that people feel about not being able to get ahead is universal, right? And so if we try to address and talk about inequities and making sure that things are fair, we're speaking about making it more fair for everyone. This is about working people. It's not just about Black working folks or Latino working folks. It's about working people, and that high tide will raise all ships. Point number two was that Donald Trump won by razor thin margins. And so to the extent that the anger is translating into disengagement, that this is the place, this is the opportunity to try to have these conversations anew. We're going to take a really quick break. Again, we want your input here, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. The conversation continues with political editor Dan Schaefer. How do Democrats talk about racial justice after this election cycle that we've seen? Our conversation continues after these brief messages.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
You're a rich girl and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch, girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far.
What is up, y'all? Welcome back. Welcome if you're just joining us. I don't know about you, but I don't have any rich man's money. I don't got no sugar daddy. It's just me and you having great conversations. I'm joined this half hour and for a little extra by Dan Schaefer, our political editor here at Civic Media. We were talking about the Race Forward conference I attended last week and really, like, how folks that work in the racial justice space and are concerned with the fact that our country made mistakes, that we created policies that made it harder for Black and brown folks to compete on equal footing. And what do we do now about those mistakes? It's an interesting moment in the post-Trump election world. And Dan, I was pointing out that there were two themes that came at least to the fore for me from the conference. And the first one was, hey, if we talk about fixing mistakes and doing better by everyone and making sure that everyone has the opportunity to fulfill their American dream, and that we talk about things like corruption in government, that we are really clear about what money in politics does, what conflicts of interest do. And those things don't harm just Black and brown folks, but they harm all working people. Now, Black and brown folks, they get it the worst at the tip of the spear, as does any community that hasn't traditionally had their hands on the reins of power and economic might in this country. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was, let's not overdo the emphasis on Trump's victory. It was extremely narrow. We know that gerrymandering has been expertly executed in this country over the last decade plus, and that there is a pathway forward. And again, it's to center working people and what is fair for working people, and that that focus will help us continue to address and redress the mistakes that our country has made and policies specifically designed to ensure that white folks got more ahead than Black folks did. And that legacy is well documented. Dan, I thought we could just round out this conversation. And then I wanted to ask you a bit about what Robin Voss has had to say about the new values and priorities for this next budget cycle.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it was so interesting to be there at that type of conference in this particular moment, right? And I think everybody is trying to, you know, understand the best path forward to address issues like racial justice in a second Trump term. But as you were having conversations with people there, you know, was there anything you learned that maybe surprised you, that maybe you weren't expecting people to say in this particular moment?
I was surprised by the level of energy and enthusiasm. I thought it was going to be morose. And there were certainly...
You thought it was going to have a little funeral vibe to it?
Yes. And it wasn't. I'll just share this moment with you because it was so amazing. They basically had some folks that came out and spoke before the keynote address by Joy Reid. And the last... group to address this general plenary, all the conference attendees, wasn't a speaker. It was a musical act. And they played a bunch of numbers. And I forget what the last one was, but it was like an old R&B classic hit. They did a musical, like an instrumental version of it. And I think it was like Come Together or whatever it was. And legitimately, here was the moment that surprised me the most. About 2,500 people got up out of their chairs in this massive auditorium and started to do the electric slide together. And people were like hugging and celebrating being together. And the joy and the commitment and the energy to do the work, despite the obstacles, despite the way that our political dialogue has degraded into a lot of us and them thinking, it was clear that the people in that room viewed this as us from a really big tent party perspective and were excited to be together and to recommit to this work and to think about how to make the work of racial justice not just about racial justice, but to connect the dots between what racial justice means and what economic justice and economic fairness means to every single working person in the United States. And that, to me, was a surprising and joyful and together moment.
Well, that's great. I think it, you know, we can all be resigned to despair in a difficult time like this, but I think it's great that there's still some joy, still some optimism and people coming together and finding a common cause to get together on. I think that's great.
And one thing, and it's interesting because this dovetails and it sets up a bit about what I wanted to talk with you about Robin Voss's recent comments is one area that people talked about a lot was public education and the fact that all of us believe that you should be able to send your child to your local public school or a public school in your district and feel very confident that they're going to get a top-notch education, that we want to see educational attainment outcomes reducing disparities. We want to see all of our students here in the state of Wisconsin and well beyond doing better and succeeding, and that we face a public school funding crisis in this country. It's not just in Wisconsin, though it is more acute in other places. And I thought this was a really interesting moment because Robin Voss had some specific things to say about budget priorities as well as educational funding. And I wanted to talk to you about that, especially on the heels of the Wisconsin Policy Forum's analysis of the overall tax burden that Wisconsinites face. We used to be a high tax state. We're now in the bottom like 15 tax states while our state government continues to sit on a massive surplus of billions of dollars. And yet everywhere from Ashland right to Ashwaubenon, from Waukesha to Wausau, Wisconsin Dells, from the Door Peninsula to Southwest Wisconsin and Richland Center. All of our public schools are hurting. So, Dan, let's take a listen. Cardi, we're going to go ahead and take, let's, if you don't mind, Dan, let's take the budget priorities sound first. This is going to be cut three. And then I want to listen immediately to cut two as well. This is, again, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who hasn't been to work since February. They've been out of session since February. Let's see what Robin Voss is articulating as some of the Republicans' budget priorities.
As well. In your mind, from what you have seen so far, what is dead on arrival?
We're not going to give $1 billion to the university. I can tell you that's probably not going to happen. I think it's unlikely that we're going to give Superintendent Underley's request for this massive increase in education spending when we just gave the largest increase in a generation like 18 months ago. So that is nothing but a political document.
And let's take a listen also to the budget priorities. This is cut three, Cardi.
As well. In your mind, from what you have seen so far, what is dead on arrival?
So, we're not going to give $1 billion to the university. I think it's unlikely. Absolutely not. It's the opposite. There are some parts of Wisconsin where people want to spend more money and they have every right to do that. If they want to raise their taxes at the ballot box, I support that idea. The idea that we're going to do it for them and take the burden on for every single district if it was the same, that's just wrong for the state.
The governor.
So a lot to unpack there. What I heard from Speaker Voss was we're not going to give more money to the University of Wisconsin system, which used to be the crown jewel and the thing that every Wisconsinite was very, very proud of. Second, we're not going to reinvest in a major way. We're not going to increase our spending in education writ large. We're going to turn down the Superintendent of Education's requested budget. And we're not going to look at increasing education spending overall. We're going to force local jurisdictions to go to referendum to appropriately fund their public schools. Are those the three main takeaways? What else am I missing, Dan? And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it is, you know, it's a really interesting interview that Robin Voss had on Upfront over the weekend. You know, he was so quiet for so much of the year, wasn't he? Like as the campaigns were going on, perhaps he knows he's a deeply unpopular figure on a statewide level as Assembly Speaker. But, you know, I think this is an interesting preview of what's ahead. And I think you have the classic argument in the state of Wisconsin, which, well, should we increase funding for things like education, things like healthcare, or should we cut taxes? And I think you mentioned that Wisconsin Policy Forum document that was released showing that Wisconsin's has significantly decreased the tax burden on individuals, but I think it has also hollowed out the public sector in so many ways, and it has cut education funding. And we just saw, you know, what was it? How many different, like you mentioned, how many different referenda across the state were passed in this election to fund education at the same time that we have this $4 billion budget surplus. And I always think it's interesting when Robin Voss talks about this in terms of we, and he's saying we in terms of we as the Republican leadership in the state assembly, not we as the people of Wisconsin who want greater funding for our schools.
Yeah. And one of the things that consistently bugs me about politics writ large, but especially where I think a lot of the policy debates have devolved to, is the presentation of things as a false choice. You can, Robin Voss talks about this like, oh, well, you know, you dummies in your local government, you can go, you know, raise taxes and do that crazy stuff, but we're done doing it. And your choice is just assume that your educational system is fine, or you're these out of control, big tax and spend Democrats. That's not reality. Right. The reality is when he talks about like a once in a generation investment in education, it's because you, Robin Voss, and the GOP in the state of Wisconsin executed a decade plus long once in a generation defunding of public education while overseeing the use of middle class taxpayer dollars to fund private education for increasingly well-to-do families and religiously based education, whatever the merits may be. So it's completely disingenuous and a false choice to say we can either have out of control taxation or you can have maybe an okay public. No, you can do both. And I don't have a problem with reducing taxes on the middle class. I have a problem with reducing taxes on people like Tim Michaels, whose business is worth $3.6 billion. I have a problem reducing taxes for Ron Johnson when our public education systems have been starved over during Robin Voss's leadership of, frankly, Wisconsin politics for 15 years. That's actually where we're at. And it's, you know, in a rural community, when Robin Voss says, go to a referendum to fund your schools, he's telling rural working people in this state to go kick rocks, that your students, that your children don't matter so much. And the reason that that is true, in my opinion, Dan, is that school systems like Milwaukee's are big and can absorb and at least handle some of those budgetary reductions in the short term. Over the long term, it decimates the school system. But unlike those big school systems, rural school systems can't bear that. It has an immediate deleterious negative impact on the quality of education. It's just wrong on all fronts. Like, we can have great public schools, we can fund them, we can invest in the technology that they need, and we can make sure that taxpayer dollars aren't being wasted.
Yeah, and we shouldn't be accepting worse outcomes just to give the U-Lines another tax break, to give Diane Hendricks another tax break. We can and should do both. We can and should do better for the students of Wisconsin. So I think education is going to be a real flashpoint in the budget next year. As Robin Voss, you know, emerges from his campaign year hibernation, he gets back to, you know, talking about these budget priorities. We're going to have a pretty difficult fight, but much closer margins. So it'll be interesting to see if there are some swing votes, perhaps, in the Assembly and Senate in the year ahead as well.
Watch this space. Education in Wisconsin matters. It matters to each and every one of us. Thanks to Dan Schaefer, our political editor. I'll come back with some final thoughts on this Tuesday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Much what boys say, but maybe what I say. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's the last segment of the day before my great friend Dom Salvia takes over the airwaves. There might be a little bit of overtime with Maggie on the Dom Salvia Show. So if you haven't quite gotten enough, you're going to want to keep it locked all through the afternoon. And don't you worry, if you've missed any of the real news and great conversation that we have every day here, you can subscribe to Civic Media's newsletter by going to civicmedia.us/email. You'll start your day with news from your community every weekday with Civic Media's Local News Roundup podcast. Check that out. Click on that link and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Check that out. Dom coming up next. We were just talking about education funding, which I think, and it sounded like Dan agrees, Dan Schaefer, our political editor here, agrees that education funding is going to continue to be a political flashpoint here in the state of Wisconsin, and rightly so. I thought it used to be like the political, like, third rail that you don't screw with educational funding. And for Robin Voss to get on Upfront News and say, like, we're done with education funding, when every single parent of a school-age child in the state of Wisconsin knows your public school system needs more money, when we're facing the reality of Donald Trump trying to eliminate the Department of Education, which is going to make it way harder for school systems to get the federal funding that they have relied upon in the past, is downright irresponsible. If you'd like to get your last thoughts in, 855-75-CIVIC, that's 855-752-4842. Keith, you had some thoughts this afternoon. Please go ahead, sir.
Can you hear me okay, Maggie?
I sure can. Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, yeah, so I am so frustrated by all of this, and it's been going on for many, many years now with the separation of the haves and have-nots in this country, and now it's even gotten into the education system where you have communities that, sure, they can pass a referendum, but there are many that cannot pass. And so those school systems are going to get much less funding, and they're going to have much less educated students, or much more poorly educated students, whichever way you want to look at it. And it's so frustrating because, you know, everybody says, oh, everybody's equal. Everyone has an equal chance in the United States. Everyone has a great chance in America. No matter where you're from, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, you know what? If you live in Madison, Wisconsin, and you go to a good school, yes. But if you live outside of Madison or some of these communities, or even Racine or inner Milwaukee, you know, La Follette in Madison. I went to La Follette 40 years ago. No, they have no chance. And I'm sick and tired of, you know, the Republicans saying, oh, everyone's got a shot. Everyone gets the same education. No, they don't.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly apt, Keith. I'd make these slight adjustments, right? Yes, the whole principle behind public education was trying to level the playing fields. But the quality of our schools varies hugely based on the property tax base of the community in which you reside. Because we redlined the hell out of our cities, right? If you happen to live in an area of Milwaukee or in other parts of the state where you do not have, frankly, really high property values, it's going to drag down your school system. I want to know when it seemed to be a wise idea to fund public schools through property taxes. It sets up a system where the richy rich that live in the gated communities with the high property values have the incredibly great public schools, and folks that live in more struggling communities are what? Supposed to be like, that's just fine. And we know that redlining helped promote segregation, was explicitly explicitly racist public policy adopted in the United States not that long ago, and that we're still struggling with the effects of that. So Keith, 100%. We need to interrogate whether the opportunities that we swear up and down create this meritocratic system are actually fair and accessible, equal opportunities to all. Because I'm with Keith here. We're not providing that to our kids. And Robin Voss is not only wrong, he's irresponsible by acting like his irresponsible to act like his obligation to ensure that every single child in the state of Wisconsin, whether you're from Ashwaubegon, Ashland, or Waukesha, has an equal chance to make their American dream come true through hard work and education. Turning your back on public schools in the state of Wisconsin isn't going to help any of us do any better. Shame on you, Robin Voss. I cannot believe that we haven't had enough time to talk about government corruption, but I will start there on Monday. I'm going to leave you all with a little note from Archibald Cox. He wrote this to his civics class back in May of 1994, and he said this, that the lessons from Watergate, that there are two things to learn. First, we should be reminded of the corrupt influence of great power, especially when the power is in the hands of someone who is willing to resort to any tactic, however wrong, to retain and increase his power. Second, thoughtful Americans should be reminded of the essential but fragile character of our traditional constitutionalism, of the rule of law inherited from England, which holds that even the very highest officials are bound by law. that all men are equal under the law. With those remarks, I will send you all off to Dom Salvia. Don't forget to tune in tomorrow for our Thanksgiving Eve show right here on the Maggie Don Show. You got Dom Salvia up next. Y'all take care.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.